You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast in association with Choose Health, and this is session 11. Welcome once again to the Physio Matters podcast with me, Jack Chu. This episode breaks new ground as our favourite tendon geek, Seth O'Neill, becomes the first podcast guest to return for a second recording. I clearly didn't do a good enough job of irritating him, so I assure you I've tried harder this time out. Following the International Tendon Symposium held in Oxford in September, we thought it would be helpful for clinicians to summarise the conference piece by piece, but only with the pertinent clinically relevant points. So in session 11, me and Seth moved from the Achilles up the lower limb to the patella and the lateral glutes before discussing some rarer tendinopathies such as the hamstrings and tib post. We then move up the upper limb for the shoulder and elbow, focusing on similarities and differences identified by research, experience, and a large dollop of common sense. So our returning podcast guest, Seth O'Neill, is a PhD candidate researching Achilles tendinopathy, amongst other things. He manages this whilst lecturing at Leicester and Coventry universities and running a private practice in Nottingham. How he manages this whilst remaining active on Twitter and contributing to several blogs, we don't know. And many have called for a journalistic expose that might explain how he does it. It has been speculated that performance-enhancing supplements may be contributing to his success, but then again, we know that they're not good for tendons. Session 11 is very much a summary, therefore if you want detailed specifics, sign up for the show notes newsletter for some reading, including some of Seth's academic work. After an hour's listening, you should feel equipped to tackle tendinopathy with evidence-based reasoning and treatment parameters. And if you don't learn anything new, please get in touch via email to be registered for our special Smug Smart Arse edition to be recorded on the 30th of February next year. Many thanks to those who've already emailed following previous episodes. We've already registered your names. So here's session 11, Treating Tendons. Welcome back, Seth. Am I all right to direct people to session 6 for your introduction, or have you radically changed your day job in the last 6 months?
Thankfully, nothing's changed that much in the last 6 months, so go back to session 6, it'll be great.
What's new in the world of tendons then since we last spoke?
There's a little bit of change, possibly coming anyway. So we've had the big tendon conference in September in Oxford. A lot of the people are starting to consider centrally sensitized changes and the occurrence of that in tendinopathy, but there seems to be a big split between the upper limb and the lower limb. So it seems to be a case of, yes, we have the evidence for it in the upper limb, but in the lower limb we don't necessarily have the evidence yet. There is a paper just come out, I think, on the patella tendon showing that there is some central changes, but a recent study on the Achilles showed that there didn't seem to be if we use just pressure pain thresholds. So I think that's going to be one of the big changes. Isometrics is probably the other thing that's obviously, we know on Twitter's going on, and everyone seems to be sort of on board with it, but the general sort of physio population aren't necessarily aware of using isometrics for tendon pain. So that's probably the other big thing that's going to change as well at some point, is the awareness of that.
Brilliant. And so today we're going to talk mainly about treating tendons. We're going to systematically go through each body part, and we'll obviously then bring up the split between the upper and lower limbs. But before we descend into specifics of each of the common tendinopathies, are there any general principles in terms of treating tendons that we can apply?
Yeah, I think there's some really simple principles that we need to look at. The obvious one that everyone talks about is load. How the hell we define load and what load means is one of those questions, I guess. And it's different when we're talking about the lower limb versus the upper limb. The lower limbs, predominantly when we talk about patella and Achilles, are energy storage tendons. So we're talking about elastic sort of energy storage and then release. Whereas when we're talking about maybe the glutes and the upper limb, we're talking about positional tendons that hold the limbs in certain positions. And the demands on them are different. So the load profile for the upper limb versus some of the lower limb are quite different.
Okay.
So how we think of like the Achilles and the patella is things like running, where the tendon gets stretched, it stores some energy, and then you sort of recoil it forwards to propulse it and get a better muscle tendon unit function. So I think that's probably the simplest load component that we need to consider. And then we'd need to consider, really, from a management perspective, that what we're trying to do often is rehabilitate the person to what they need to be doing. Mm. And it's just a simple case, like all physio, of breaking down what the demands of that job or sport is and trying to gradually allow the person to get there. So that's really, I think, the key principles. So it's effectively load management, strengthening, looking at then this progressive rehab all the way up to where they need to be. But we've got to integrate some energy storage demands for the right tendons later in the rehab. And that's often what gets missed out in the current sort of climate, really.
I see.
Use a lot of strength training. And then the one other thing I would add in is, for most of the tendons that are insertional, which is pretty much everything bar the Achilles mid tendon, we need to consider compression and how to take the tendon out of that compressed position. So that's the big thing, I think, that often we miss out. It's understanding that. So today, as we go through each area, what we'll try and do is sort of think about the compressed position for those tendons and how that we might move them out of that position initially to load them and then go from there.
And that's a great point in terms of the different tendons have different compressive patterns. But does that mean that we can demonize stretching, shall we say? Has that become a real faux pas in tendons that we shouldn't be doing that typical static stretch, which has been commonplace?
Yeah, I've not liked stretching for years and years and years. That primarily stems from the fact that I don't see tendons that are particularly, or muscle tendon units that are that shortened. Although people say dorsiflexions are a risk factor for the Achilles, which is obviously where most of my work is, the same paper that found that, if you actually look at it, showed that increased dorsiflexion was a risk factor, but they didn't report on that. And the actual sort of ratio was only sort of a slight difference, really. So increased or reduced range of motion is a risk factor. Whether we see that, that's the key thing. So if the muscle tendon unit is shorter, stretching could be argued to be beneficial, but why not use a strengthening program that goes into end range, which actually will add sarcomeres? There's a good systematic review by Kieran O'Sullivan in the British Journal of Sports Med that looks at eccentrics and how it can add sarcomeres. So sarcomeregenesis, they call it. And there's a bit of evidence that supports that. So if we're going to do something, I'd work the muscle in its end range, as long as that doesn't compress the insertion, to try and add length to the muscle tendon unit rather than stretching.
So the risks certainly outweigh the benefits when it comes to that.
But for me, in my opinion on it, yeah, some people, I think, will occasionally use stretching, but of the world experts that are out there, I don't think any of them would promote stretching as a really integral part of rehab management for these. The other aspect is, and it depends on who you talk to, tendons, when they've got tendinopathy, some people think they're stiffer, some people think they're more pliable or more flexible, so there's less stiffness. I think that they tend to be more pliable, so that there's less stiffness there. So if you're stretching a muscle tendon unit, you're only making it looser, flexible. And that would seem totally sort of against what we're after, which is to make the tendon stiff again. So understanding tissue pliability or flexibility is probably important with it.
When it comes to frontline clinical practice, I know that you've canvassed a little bit when it comes to your research, and it's still the big word that comes up, though, isn't it? Stretch. So we need to disseminate that further, you feel?
Yeah, absolutely. When I did the survey of UK runners looking at what treatments they'd had, stretching was the big sort of word that came out in the word cloud. Now, I'm hoping that most of that was actually eccentric exercises, but they thought it was stretching. And a lot of physios still talk about it as stretching. And I think we've got to get away from stretching the tendons and look at actually trying to just increase the muscle capacity or the muscle tendon capacity more.
Right, as we did last time, it might, hopefully it's sort of semantics and it's probably not a stretch per se, but you never know. And hopefully we can get this out there and change practice, of course. Often a topic that comes up when a patient has been rehabilitated back to as near full function as appropriate is then the way in which maintenance, and it's not just tendons, but generally, toothbrush exercises, they're often called. How should people continue to just dabble with rehabilitation across all tendons?
Yeah, well, the risk factors for developing tendinopathy are previous tendinopathy and previous injury. They're the biggest risk factors that came out of our Delphi study last year. And taking that into account, then you think, okay, well, why is it a risk factor? We know from rehab that we've done and the study we've done that you don't rehabilitate muscle strength. And the experts in our study suggested that maintenance regimes of doing 2 times a week's weight training would be preventative of tendinopathy. And that would seem to make perfect sense, both in terms of conditioning the tendon to make the tendon structure stay healthy, but also keeping the muscle tendon unit functioning appropriately. So my advice to patients after I've treated them is to continue 2 sessions a week of heavy strength training, heavy loading. And that's ideally done at a gym, or get rucksack out and stick some decent weights in it. And the cheapest way of getting some decent weights for patients is to go down to B&Q and buy a 25 kilo bag of builder's sand and stick that in the rucksack, and potentially buy 2 or 3 of them and use those in a rucksack for the lower limb stuff. I'm not suggesting we use this for the upper limb. I'd struggle to lift one of those up into abduction. But yeah, I think strength training is paramount. Why it is, we don't know. Whether that's neuromuscular, as suggested by Pete Malieris's systematic review the other year, or whether that's tendon conditioning, is probably both.
Going to be a bit of everything.
Yeah.
And it makes sense in all facets. We've talked about this mix of tendons, specifically as structures, the neuromuscular unit, as well as the neurological factors. As far as what we understand of tolerance, both in physiology, mechanics, and neurologically, maintenance makes sense, doesn't it? Just to condition that and make it used to it is a good thing.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's normally what triggers it off in the first place. They weren't used to the load that they asked the tendon to do during those days or weeks. So they've had like a holiday, come back and loaded it, and that's triggered it. Or they've just ramped up their distance far too fast, if we think about lower limb problems. Or if we think patella, ramped up their load on it by deep squats far too quickly. So yeah, it is about tissue tolerance. It's maybe central tolerance as well. Whack the two together and you've got a nice, happy medicine that works to hopefully prevent tendinopathy. And that's where I'd like to be going in the future, is looking at prevention schemes, which is where we're trying to build the work now.
And so in our last podcast, in and around the TA, as we called it, we thoroughly covered assessment and we stopped short of explaining treatment. It was the elephant in the room, so to speak, that we purposely left, because I know you were getting some research out there at the conference. So what's the latest on treating the TA specifically?
So where my research was going and how I was trying to slant it is, at the moment we've focused on the tendon and how to change the tendon and get the tendon better. Whereas actually that's probably not the only thing, and certainly doesn't change during the rehab interventions we do. Some people are focusing then on central changes and suggesting it's all about that, or nearly all about that. And neither is it that. We've got to remember the tendon is part of a muscle tendon unit. And the muscle, in my opinion, has the ability to shield the tendon. So if the muscle's strong, it can effectively, normally in an eccentric loading pattern, actually shock absorb for the tendon. And there's research that supports that, but it's not been applied to tendinopathy research.
Why do you think that might be? I know this is a really awkward question, but why is that accidentally avoided or blinkered?
I don't know. I don't know whether people just focused on the tendon in the past and really sort of said, oh, it's all about changing the tendon structure, which was obviously where we used to think the clinical benefit was. We now know it's not. So we've started to look further afield, which has then led to the central sort of changes that have been identified. But people seem to have forgotten the muscle. So what we've been looking at is the muscle deficits in plantar flexors and whether they exist between a patient population and a healthy control. And then we've looked at what happens with an intervention. And we're also then doing a regression analysis, which allows you to work out how much the strength change corresponds to the clinical change. And findings at this moment in time look very promising, that a proportion of the clinical benefit is around changing the muscle power. But of course, whilst we change muscle strength, the tendon will adapt as well. Mm. But with our current imaging techniques, we can't see any change in the tendon. But if we chopped it open, there probably are some sort of smaller changes that don't get picked up on a sort of UTC scan or an ultrasound scan.
So the rehab's not radically different. It's just the mechanism of effect is broader. So it's tendon, muscle, and central changes needs to be accounted for, you feel?
Absolutely, yeah. I think we've got to encompass all of these things. And as we talked about in the last podcast, use pain science as well to explain how the psychological and social components might play into affecting the person's rehabilitation, prevention of them doing the exercises and whatever else. So I think we need to cover all of those elements. It's not, I'm not saying it's just about changing the muscle, but I think the muscle's been missed a little bit, and the muscle's quite important to the clinical changes that occur.
Okay, fantastic. And so if we think about then, let's treat this Achilles tendon that is tendinopathic then, where are we at, both in your opinion and then the consensus that came off the conference?
So everyone has, I think, the same sort of approach to treating now from a physiotherapeutic perspective of we've got to increase the load tolerance of the muscle tendon unit rather than just the tendon. And the way we would do that was if we've got a highly irritable tendon, so the reactive stage, we might use isometrics maybe to control pain. Isometrics allow you to dose the tendon a little bit easier because you can say, right, I want you to load it at this type of weight for this length of time. And that's a bit different from getting somebody to do reps that are isotonic, where actually how long it takes them to do 10 reps might be very different between person to person. Mm-hmm. So I think in the early stages, the isometrics are useful because it allows the dosage to be controlled a little bit easier.
How are we identifying that dosage? I know it's awkward, but... And I don't want a recipe from you,
yeah.
But if isometrics could be resisted against the towel at 30%, or it could be single leg stand mid heel raise. So where would you advise our listeners to identify an appropriate dosage?
As with anything, it's always what the patient can tolerate. So a lot of it's about how the tendon reacts to that load. So It's about looking at the patient when they come in, going through your ags and eases and seeing how long they can tolerate certain activities like walking, having some knowledge about how much load that puts through the tendon. So walking is probably 2 to 2.5 times your body weight through the Achilles tendon region and the plantar flexors. So we use that information, work out how far they can walk, try and come up with is this person really irritable? In which case we might use less of a dose. But we always measure that dose with, as I call it to the patients, the aftermath. It's you've done your exercise. How does it then feel afterwards? I don't worry about pain during loading. It's pain after the loading. Particularly the morning after is useful. But equally, we can use the few hours after that evening as well.
So in clinical practice, we need to be explaining the principles, giving them options, and then telling them to go away and play with it as a trial and error between sessions. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's exactly how I do it. But that's not just how I would treat a tendon. That's how I treat all disorders, yeah, whether it's back pain or whatever.
Yeah,
pain during the movements isn't a sign of doing something bad. Pain that persists for a long period afterwards shows that you've irritated whatever we think the structure might be or the sort of the pain mechanism may be. And we don't want to overly irritate people because that then leads to them doing less the next day, which then actually leads to them getting structurally weaker, both from a muscle and a tendon perspective.
Okay.
And they become more fearful of doing their exercises because it hurt them so much.
Mm-hmm. And so from what I can tell, with the isometric science is fantastic, but it doesn't stand alone. So then if we were to say there's an athlete or a patient that would have an isometric part of their rehab as well as a concentric and eccentric, how do we mix those together?
The isometrics is only really useful in the early stage for pain, just to get some control so we can start the loading program. It's not the be all and end all. So the Monash guys that are doing it, so Ebony and Jill and everyone, they're not suggesting we just do isometrics and it rehabs people. They're suggesting we use it to get some control of symptoms and then we progressively load back up to whatever they need to be able to tolerate. The addition to that is isometrics that are very heavy loading. So talking about sort of 1.5 to 2.5 times body weight may adapt the structure in the muscle and the tendon quite a lot more than the sort of 70% loading that they're suggesting for pain relief.
Mm-hmm.
So we might use the really heavy load stuff for the more athletic group as well. But other than that, we want to be looking at using isotonics. So if we stick with the Achilles for now, then it's just doing a heel raise and a slow lower with some weight in. A backpack or something similar, so the person's working at that heavy sort of dosage.
Mm-hmm.
They need to use heavy weights, and I can safely say that because our research that we've sort of recently done, and I'm sure you'll have the links to the abstracts on BGSM. The research we did showed that the eccentric strength for a healthy runner should be 2 times their body weight, whilst the injured population were 136% of their body weight. So there's quite a big deficit when they've got tendinopathy.
Right.
And when we used normal eccentrics with running as well, they didn't change that much. They got to 160% of their body weight as a percentage of strength, compared to the 200% it should be eccentrically.
Okay.
And that was asking them to use a backpack and trying to build up to half their body weight. But very few people ever got anywhere near doing anything like that. I think 15, 20 kilos was about the most people got up to. So I think it's a case of we need external load to be integrated at some stage in order to rehabilitate the muscles appropriately.
Mm.
And I'd be pretty sure that that applies to all tendons,
okay.
Certainly the lower limb ones.
Yeah.
And we just don't rehab people properly.
Now, do you feel like we don't maybe, because most would introduce weight, I feel, but maybe not early enough, do you think? Or do they stop short of getting it high enough?
I think often clinically, from my observations, people, if they're using an eccentric regime, often don't get patients to use body weight. And if we're talking about a sedentary group, they're going to be less inclined to start to use external weight on top of their body weight.
Okay.
So I think they just miss it and don't ever get there.
Okay.
Now, the only other thing I'd add in is that rehab we did had fantastic clinical shifts. So our average in 24 patients was a 30-point shift on a VISA A scale, which is huge. It's bigger than most of the published research out there on other approaches. I think, obviously, it's a relatively small sample, 24 patients, but I think the added benefit of showing them where their strength was encouraged a better adherence to training to actually understand the protocol of what they're aiming to do.
Mm.
So at the moment, what we're doing is looking at taking people using a concentric eccentric regime now of heavy loading through the same type of 12-week period to see how it corrects those deficits, to see if we can get a better change with it.
And was there anything then that came off the back of treating the Achilles that highlighted that certain injections are indicated, certain other adjunctive methods need to be explored alongside identifying the loading profile?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a split in the research groups and okay. where they're based in. So the Aussies are mostly, from my understanding, shying away from certainly doing any injection therapies. And I think Pete Melieras uses high volume injections and shockwave therapy. But the rest of the guys over there, whether we're talking the hip or the knee or the Achilles, don't really use any other adjuncts from that component.
Mm-hmm.
Dylan Morrissey in London's doing quite a bit of research using shockwave therapy and high volume injections in the clinic they work in. Mm-hmm. And I know he's come up with a pathway where you start loading. If they're struggling with loading, you look at shockwave therapy to try and denervate the tendon, to get rid of the sort of nerves there, to get rid of pain for a bit. Then you try and get them loading again. If that fails, you do another shockwave treatment at about 6 weeks. And if they still just struggle to do the loading regime, then they might go on to a high volume and then look at doing that. So they're really trying to use the shockwave and the high volume to remove the pain for a period of time.
Qualify the loading.
Yeah, to allow them to load it. The loading seems to be always the critical thing. No matter who you talk to, it's doing those exercises that are important. I think we really need to understand why those exercises work.
Mm.
That would allow us to then design better rehab.
Of course. In practice, do you feel, because I don't feel like I encounter that group that isometrics can't downregulate things effectively if they are compliant. So do you clinically encounter those patients that you think, oh, I wish I had a shockwave machine today?
No, is the easy answer. I don't know whether I just don't see the really, really highly reactive patients or whether it's just the other components of the treatment that I'll use with people. So I've said it, I think, in the last podcast, I'm a big fan of Peter O'Sullivan and his style of work. So this cognitive functional therapy, we change the patient's beliefs and sort of thoughts about what's going on whilst using function to do that, rather than doing purely cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I will integrate that with all my patients, whoever
regardless.
They are, whether okay. we're talking ankle OA, Achilles tendons, or whether we're talking back pain. And I think by helping them understand what the pain means and that it doesn't necessarily correlate to damage and everything else, we get a better sort of understanding. The patient's less fearful, they're happier to load, and their psychological bits aren't upregulating their pain perception. I haven't had anyone that I've sort of had to resort to anything else with for many years. I have patients I occasionally struggle with who are really irritable, but we can always get them loading to a degree. And the reason we struggle is normally because they've misunderstood what I've said, or they've gone and chatted with another friend and then they've done something different to what we asked them to. So they've overloaded it, stirred it up, and then we've had to try and get them settled before we can load again.
Yeah.
Whether the shockwave would give faster outcomes, I don't know, because like we said, with the treatment we used, we have had some fantastic clinical change with what is considered normal sort of therapy, really. We've also treated about 8 or 9 patients who'd previously failed eccentric rehab. They came into the study, but they weren't in the study data because that was one of the things we should have excluded.
Mm-hmm.
They were still weak when we analysed them at the start, and they hadn't done the regimes particularly that well. And they all benefited really well, despite having had it in the past and theoretically failed. Okay. So I think when we have failures, we've got to look at whether the patient's really understood what we've said, done the regime appropriately, and given it the appropriate length of time. And it's often the time that's the biggie. Patients think it should be a few weeks, and that's where then they get disheartened and will look at a quicker fix, which may be one of the other adjunct type therapies.
Okay, fantastic. And we've covered a lot of the, shall we say, the basic science, the broad loading profile, and that word's going to keep coming up, isn't it? But if we move up the body, rather than covering, of course, all the old tracks, how does the patellar tendon differ when it comes to treating it? What was the consensus on that one?
Patellar tendon disorders are primarily compressive, so we've got to look at taking it out of compression. And one of the key things that you seem to hear from the groups that see a lot of patellar tendinopathy is that the time spent in a deep squat, especially if you talk to like the Aussie rules football guys or the rugby union or rugby league guys here, it seems to often be triggered by doing the weight sessions in deep squatting. So they get a new strength and conditioning coach in, they beast them in those new positions, and that seems to then trigger symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, if you're talking about guys in the scrum, that's a position they're working in quite a lot as well. So it's really about taking them away from that compressed position, working them a little bit into a more extended position, and then also looking at isolation, because we often focus on functional loading strategies, so closed chain, and actually what you'll find is they can sometimes cope with that well and they look strong, but you then isolate the muscle by doing a seated knee extension or something and you'll see a big difference.
So don't overly rely on the squats, in which the glutes can sort of cheat you.
I really wouldn't rely on it at all. Mm-hmm. I think we alluded to it last time with the plantar flexors. Isolation is critical, and again, that seems to be a consensus that comes back from the physios that are doing these things. And I do think isolation is critical, despite what we often think of functions best. We need to isolate it because we can control the load better, which allows us not to flare people up and get better adherence.
So a balance between the two then. So my patellar tendinopathy patient, we want to avoid that deep compressive squat. Yep. I've seen a lot of that in the CrossFit community as well as, of course, rugby. But so there's a place for the more functional squat-based protocols, as well as you need to be doing some knee extension stuff. In practice, is TheraBand enough? Do we need to make sure they go to the gym and do that leg extensions?
Yeah, they need to make sure they're fatiguing the muscles. That's often how I look at it, is that they want to feel the muscle have a bit of a burn afterwards, like it's worked. And it will be the muscle that hurts with these things rather than the tendon normally, because we're not asking the tendons to energy store with a strength slow program like that. So it shouldn't be sort of having undue load on it. TheraBand's probably not enough in my experience, but if it works for the patient because they're that weak, fine.
Yeah.
As long as they feel that burn and they feel like they've done something suitable, it's enough. But the ideal thing is getting them really probably into a gym and doing it, or setting something up at home so they do it isometrically against the wall. So they put the foot against the wall whilst they're sat in the chair and just trying to push out against it in that way.
Okay.
That would offer something at least that's a bit more sort of significant load.
Okay, yeah, breaking walls down, I like it. And so before we move on to another common problem area, which would be the lateral hip that you just mentioned, is there any emerging research on other lower limb tendons, such as maybe tib post, the proximal and distal hamstrings? And if there's minimal research, how might we manage those tendons any differently to what we've talked about?
Yeah, I think it's applying the same principles to those tendons. So tib post is often sort of compression and does link with the dreaded word of pronation. So however we want to term that and what we're really saying is happening at the subtalar joint, I don't mind. But effectively, you're getting compression around the medial malleolus. So trying to take them out of that position can be useful, which may be looking at orthotics and referring to a good podiatrist. Or it may simply be looking at activities to correct that position. But there's no new research that I'm aware of on these other tendons at the moment. They seem to be areas that aren't well applied at the moment by anybody. Obviously, there's the recent plantar fascia study done by Michael Rathliff. And that's I think groundbreaking and really good. So I would get people to have a good peek at that. Mm-hmm. Hopefully there'll be more work into plantar fascia problems, because it obviously, as a Joe Bloggs run-of-the-mill physio seeing normal patients, that's what we see a lot of. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be very interesting. And then hamstring tendinopathy, there's a paper a few years ago, or might only have been last year, on a new outcome measure. So it's the VISA-H, so the Victorian Institute of Sports hamstring.
Very clever.
Exactly. So there's a VISA-A, VISA-H. I think there's also going to be another VISA coming out soon, but I'll leave that for somebody else to tell you about.
They need to get it sponsored by VISA. That's the next step, I think.
That'd be very nice if they did. So, the hamstring stuff, have a look at Tom Goom's blog on his when he had his tendinopathy. That's quite an interesting one. And it is, again, compression when the trunk goes forwards. So as you tilt forwards at the pelvis, you start to get compression over the ischial tuberosity of the hamstring tendon near its insertion. So most of these points aren't the actual insertion, and an enthesopathy, I can never say it, the exact point it attaches to, I'll let you say it.
Enthesopathy.
That's the one, thank you.
No worries.
They're often they're like a cam point where you've got a bit of a bone bulging into the tendon just near it. If you're doing a lot of hill work, which is what triggered Tom's off, then that will be part of it, with runners developing a sort of proximal hamstring tendinopathy. But as physios, we lean over beds a lot, and if we're doing mobilizations and stuff. And so I think that's the other part of it that we sometimes need to think about with patients, is how they're tilting the trunk going forwards and then sitting on these things day in, day out as well. But there's no real groundbreaking research that I've seen, and there wasn't, to my memory anyway, any at the conference either.
Okay. So be sensible, apply the principles we've discussed, and then try your best to isolate certain tendons in rather than just the functional stuff.
Yeah, so if you think of the hamstring, that the first thing would be to take it out of a compressive position. So don't get the person isolating the hamstring by doing seated knee curls. Get them to do knee curls in prone on a machine, or use TheraBand if you want to, or even in standing using a sort of ankle weight. But making sure the hip's basically not in a flexed range of motion, so you don't get that compression there.
Yeah.
That's the key principle, really. And then you go through this sort of isometrics if you need for pain, but otherwise isotonics, and you progressively go through slow speed strength work to faster speed work, and then start to ask it to energy store like running.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, really the key, is this sort of full rehabilitation. And often as physios, we stop when we've got them clinically better. So you don't rectify what's wrong in terms of the muscle deficits.
Yeah.
That might be the risk factor with why they develop it again. That's my gut feeling.
In real world terms for the lay person, although it is time consuming, if we can encourage them to not leave the other leg behind and to try and make sure they have a balance to their rehab from side to side, that is research supported neurologically as well as physiologically, you think?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's really important. And just to go back to our sort of calf work, the runners we had were weak on both legs. They weren't weak on just their bad leg. They're weaker on both legs compared to the healthy guys. So we need to rehab them both legs when we do rehab. And I imagine that might be the case for a lot of tendinopathies. There's not the research to substantiate it yet. And that may support central changes as well, because it is bilateral weakness.
Okay.
And it could be pre-existing weakness that they had, and that's why they developed the tendinopathy.
When it comes to greater trochanteric pain syndrome and lateral glute tendinopathy, I think it'll be worth referring listeners to brilliant podcast by our Aussie cousins, the Physio Edge podcast, as well as a more recent one with the BJSM podcast, Karim Khan's platform, with Dr. Alison Grimaldi. I understand that Alison had some further data that she shared at the conference. Where are we at with that?
So it's exactly what she's talking about with Karim Khan on the BJSM podcast that came out this week. And it's a really good, clinically useful podcast. Rather than me sort of try and go through what Alison's done, I think get the guys to have a listen to that podcast, because it is a real top one.
Brilliant. And are we brave enough to add to it in a treating tendon thing?
She goes through full strengthening program and how they progress. So primarily starting with low level loading. She uses 25 to 30% max voluntary contraction type work to start with, rather than the 70% that's been used in the patella or Achilles tendon for isometric loads.
Okay.
And progresses through from there through a full strengthening program, taking it into gait components. The big difference, really, I think, is Alison and probably Angie Fearon as well would go with it, that you want to look at trying to reduce the compression at the start. So they look at discouraging the cross-legged position and sleeping on the affected or the other affected side, and encourage sort of supine sleeping. So you're actually not having that compression at night of the tendon being stretched over your greater trochanter. And that would make a lot of sense, really, with your patients. One of the biggest problems you have with these patients is night pain.
Yeah.
And it's getting them past that night pain that's the tricky bit.
Okay.
I think Angie Fearon's got work on the bursa around there and changes in the bursa, which I think is quite interesting with it. I know from shoulder research that Jeremy Lewis has talked about before, I think it was a Japanese study or Chinese study, and they showed that people that have night pain in the rotator cuff sort of region, it was primarily related to substance P levels in the bursa. And they actually did injections into the bursa under ultrasound guidance, and that was really quite effective.
Mm.
I wonder if that's basically what Angie's shown for the hip region as well, and whether actually that type of treatment might be useful. But we have issues if we're going to inject a bursa that may allow the corticosteroid to move out into the tendon zone and further degenerate already potentially degenerative tendon.
Would it be fair for me to say that we can't ignore the, because it comes to treatment again, as we're talking about, but treating these tendons, we need to embrace the fact that the demographic and contextual nature of the people that have, or the patients that have more lateral glute tendinopathy, vastly different to those with a typical Achilles tendinopathy in a lot of ways. So treating them, we've got to recognise those differences as well.
Yeah, need to take into account the systemic risk factors. So we're often talking about postmenopausal women, so there's changes in hormones that are linked to tendinopathy. They're unfortunately, not to stereotype, but have often put on a little bit of weight and are then often trying to get fit, so they're starting to exercise more. Mm. Obviously, we've got some differences, women being the greatest sort of risk group, differences in pelvic morphology that link to that in terms of the position that a lady's pelvis is in and where the hip sockets are, and the greater trochanter increase the degree of compression compared to a male pelvis.
Mm.
So there's some of those aspects that we can't change as well. How we change those systemic risk factors, it may just be general exercise is useful to alter some of the potential cytokine involvement linked to adiposity. So cytokines are just like an inflammatory chemical that may alter tendon structures, and that's one of the hypotheses with why obesity or particularly adiposity links to tendon disease.
Mm.
So abdominal fat particularly.
Brilliant. Okay. Before we move on to the upper limb then, I've been thinking recently about trends in MSK practice, and I think it's fair to say that tendons are pretty trendy at the moment. So is anyone trying to apply tendon science principles to any other body parts? So are we getting back tendons, neck tendons, abdominal tendons?
Yes and no. It's not really been done for the back in terms of the thoracolumbar fascial area, but there was a publication earlier this year or last year on gluteal tendonopathy, but actually looking at glute max insertion into the PSIS, showing a proper insertional disorder there. So yes, it's starting to sort of come out, but from a physio point of view, we'll probably treat them as a persistent back pain type and try and actually get them to develop normal movement habits that reduce the load on that region through another mechanism. I certainly wouldn't and can't recall seeing a patient like that, but I wouldn't focus on the tendon in that instance.
No,
because there'll be so many more other sort of psychosocial factors that will really hinder the patient.
Yeah, bigger fish to fry in that sort of circumstance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they'd be better to focus on.
Oh, brilliant. And other body parts then? I know that ITB's been postulated that that's tendon-like, shall we say.
Yeah, I always say to my students, we were down doing anatomy in the cadaver room recently with the induction for the first year. So look, this is your ITB. This is your tendon for your glutes, which is effectively what it is. If you see it on a cadaver and you got TFL, your glutes affecting into the deep surface and glute max in there, it is what it is. It allows them to have an action over the knee. So absolutely. And I know Alison Grimaldi actually says exactly the same thing in the podcast that they've just done with the BGSM. So it's how it functions to a degree. It is fascia at the end of the day as well, though, but the muscles insert into it so they can have an action on it. And what really defines a tendon compared to the fascia?
Yeah, it's all these grey areas anatomically that we just need to bear in mind, but never hang his hat on. Let's load one specific thing.
Yeah, so if we looked at ITB disorders, you treat it like you would a tendinopathy in terms of it's a compressive component around the lateral epicondyle region, and they think it's a fat pad that's just there getting squashed. And you actually want to reduce compression. So it's about hip angulation or knee angulation in relation to the pelvis during weight bearing. So for runners, it's whether the knees are coming across or towards midline than they shouldn't be, or should be, sorry. So yeah, I'd definitely apply tendon management principles to the ITB. I wouldn't apply it to the neck or back particularly though. But like I said, I do use the loading type strategies and this sort of stepping stone approach of, well, you're here, you want to be there. And how I sort of always say it to the patients is, let's use a marathon as the example. So we'll go back to metaphors for a bit. If you want to run a marathon, you've got to not just train at 2 miles forever. You've got to start to do 5, 6, 7, 8 miles, build up to doing 18 before you reach race day. And they can relate to that. And we can say, well, this is where you're at. You're at baseline, 6 miles. You want your 26 and a bit miles. Well, we need to do the stepping stones to reach that. And they seem to get that sort of gist then and do the right things and progress rather than plateauing and staying at the same training level.
No, brilliant. We do love metaphors, of course.
And wouldn't be a podcast without one.
Of course. And we've briefly discussed it both in the last podcast and it's been mentioned already today, is that the upper limb tendons behave differently in many ways to those in the lower limb. And what's the latest with, say, the shoulder specifically, and how does treatment differ from the principles we've already discussed?
Okay. So from the shoulder, the latest studies are primarily probably looking at central changes. That's where most of the reviews have been done and most of the primary research has been done looking at central issues. You've got Chris Littlewood's recent self study, which was basically patients utilizing a self loading program where they used an exercise that hurt them often, so like abduction or something, and just graded that. So it's nearly like a graded exposure. And I think Chris thinks it's changing the central component and that's how you get the benefit. I think we've got to also remember that we're going to be strengthening up probably the muscles that's most weak or the muscle tendon unit as well if we pick the uncomfortable movement, and that's the other mechanism that may be involved as well. But yeah, it's a really successful study and it had very good clinical changes for those patients. So it's one to have a look at for the listeners.
Okay.
But again, it's the insertional tendinopathies when we talk about the shoulder. So we need to take them out of the compressive position. So we might actually lift them up into slight abduction away from sort of neutral really when we start to load. But equally, if we're going to say there is some subacromial component going on as well, we might not want to take them fully up there as well into 90 degrees.
Okay, and so again, isometrically, we want to load the reactive ones. That how do you do that clinically?
Yeah, I mean, isometrically to load them, it's something we've used for quite a long time. So I used to work in A&E a number of years back now, and we used to see these acute patients come in who looked like a rotator cuff rupture. So they go away using the hand as resistance and just loading with the arm slightly out to the side, often propped up with a pillow or using an arm on a chair, just to have their arm in, let's say, 20 degrees of abduction. So you're taking them out of compression. I know now, but I didn't know about at that time, because mm-hmm. this is back in sort of 2005, 2006. And we'd get them back in 3 days after they've done these isometric loads, primarily looking at abduction and lateral rotation as the two movements we'd focus on, because they were always the most symptomatic. And they'd come back and they'd have near full movement, if not full active movement, and their pain levels would be drastically dropped. So that was my first experience of reactive tendinopathy, but I never knew it was called reactive tendinopathy back then. And obviously we've used isometrics for years for the shoulders. We haven't for other tendons, and now we're starting to integrate it in. The upper limb ones are probably lower load. And how we'd progress them is we'd do the isometrics. Like I said, probably abduction and lateral rotation as the two focuses initially, but we could look at all movements. And we'd start to do it into different positions. So we'd come sort of forward into a flexion, like a horizontal flexion type position. And then we'd start to maybe go a bit further back, but I'd never go past normally a scapular plane position, so 30 degrees really, because we tend not to be working in any loaded positions out there for the majority of the patients I'm talking about, these sedentary guys. If it's a sports person, different kettle of fish. So link it with their sports and focus it to them individually. So we'd use the variation of position. We'd start to use heavier loads, push harder, push faster. So they'd do a nice steady build the pressure up to start with, and then they'd push a bit faster and quicker. And I'd always get the patients to focus on the thing that will change is they can push harder. The pain won't change, so they'll still have pain on loading, but they can push harder before the pain comes on and make sure they understand that's the first change.
Recognizing that progress.
Yeah, when they recognize that progress and it becomes easier, then we'd move to doing isotonic work. And again, it's about variation, and we start to do sort of, I'm a fan of TheraBand, I don't mind it. It's fine for the upper limb, I think. Although some people would argue we shouldn't use resistance in the upper limb because it's normally working without any resistance on it. I just think we can bring about changes in the muscles and tendons faster by using resistance. And that's
certainly clinically that makes sense, doesn't it, from what we've experienced? And then as you introduce more movements, do you try and make them quite broad, combined movements? How do you integrate
that?
Yeah,
if you want to go down the PNF route, you can use sort of patterns like that. And I think they have a place, but I'd often isolate those type of patterns where we put them up in a position of abduction and we do some lateral rotation type movements with some wrist movement at the same time. But I'd always tie it back to what they need to do from a functional perspective, where we're aiming to be at. And like I said, using the marathon again, it's saying, well, they need to do that function, let's say front crawling swimming. So let's break the action down and make sure they can do each component of it to get back there. The other thing I think then to look at is how we progress this. So we do isometrics, isotonics, strength training. We do some endurance work as well, and that endurance work might be static because often patients are having to work with a limb above their head, painting a ceiling, plastering or something. So we'd want to use some static loads, and we also want to use some compressive loads through the humerus. So that could be a wall press, it could be four-point kneeling, it could be crawling around if you've got some patients that would do that, but I don't know many that probably would. Or it could be pushing through the arm of the chairs to get from sit to stand. And the reason we use the compression, as we know from our neurophysio colleagues, is that by compressing through the arm, we fire up the cuff better. And part of what we're doing in some of these tendinopathies, especially if it involves definitely big holes in the collagen, so potential tears, is we're getting the rest of the cuff to compensate, or even some of the big prime mover muscles to compensate for what's been lost by the sort of the cuff tear in inverted brackets. So yeah, we need to use compression, and it has a very good role to play.
Okay.
We don't often need huge amounts unless you're talking about athletic groups, though. I find with most of my sedentary ones, using the wall press and just gradually moving the feet further away from the wall, and occasionally using an unstable base on the wall, like getting to push on a pillow or a towel or something, is what I use clinically. If they want to buy a diner cushion type thing, the air cushions,
okay,
like you might do standing balance rehab on. Yeah. They could buy one of those, the 12, 13 quid from Amazon.
Yeah.
I've had the odd patient buy those that's got higher demands for the shoulder. But for most patients, that will cut the mustard.
Am I fair in sort of saying that in the lower limb, as we discussed, the, introducing open chain sometimes gets ignored? Flip side, yeah. For me, closed chain gets ignored in the upper limb. So getting them to bear weight through the upper limbs is important. Clinically, that might be four-point wall pressing, but not ignoring that functionally as well. If people are going to be doing press-ups or gymnasts even, then we need to make sure we...
Absolutely.
Recognize that.
Even more simple things, getting on and off the loo, getting in and out of bed, yeah. Rolling over and pushing up. Most of us use our arms to get out of bed. And I think that's often where, when we're talking about the elderly population with bigger cuff tears, so 60s plus, that's what they're complaining of. So let's teach them how to do those things and get appropriate strength. Great.
Yeah, I'm forever explaining to patients that it's far from a bravery contest, though, with the upper limb. They quite like fighting it, but that's not necessarily what we want. So relative rest and the appropriate load, again, is important.
Yeah, so it's sussing out that loading component of how we define it. So the upper limb tendons are positional tendons. They're not so much of an energy storage tendon, particularly when we think about our normal patients, unless we're talking about a swimmer or a javelin thrower. Different then. So in your normal sort of run-of-the-mill lady or gentleman who's got rotator cuff tendinopathy and it's related to problems with normal chores, it may be holding something like a saucepan with some water in. So that's the load. It's a bit more than just the weight of their arm. And we have to look at making sure they understand that whole aftermath component we talked about earlier for the lower limb where they do their exercises and it's then how sore they are afterwards. Again, with that, probably less so in the morning actually than the lower limb. It's more about the rest of that day or the evening. And they need to then drop stuff off. The problems I can remember with a gentleman I had recently was chopping up wood. He wouldn't give up chopping up his wood for his log burner, despite it being summer and 30-odd Celsius. And we just had to sort of say, look, that's enough. You stop it for 2 weeks. It's not going to sort of be a problem. It's not cold enough yet. But breaking through to him and helping him understand that was the way we actually managed to get a breakthrough in his symptoms.
Yeah.
Because he was doing his exercises. He said he was doing less. But when you broke it down and said, what are you still doing? He was still doing quite high level axe work to break up into kindling and all sorts of other bits. So yeah, we've got to dampen down sort of the person trying to force through it and trying to make it better, because all they're going to do is irritate the bursa, the tendon more, and just stir up the symptoms so they get worse and worse and worse.
And you don't land on that without asking the pertinent question and eliciting that information and bearing in mind their psychosocial being, as you've constantly said.
Yeah, you've got to follow up those little snippets they give you that hint at something, and unless you often sort of really pin them down on those things, which is all back to our communication skills again, you miss out these fine details that really actually influence your care.
Okay, no, that's great. And is there anything else you'd like to cover when it comes to the shoulder, that especially if it came from the conference, before we move up the upper limb?
No, I think the consensus from the conference was about centrally mediated pain in the shoulder. So by that, we're talking about widespread pressure pain threshold changes, and they use quantitative sensory testing, which is a category of testing different sensory components, including microfilament testing. They like to use the little hairs, von Frey hairs, I think they are, to look at how the sensation's altered, and they can show that with shoulders you get this widespread change. So we have to think of that from a patient representation, that these patients then might do an activity and have a latent response that's out of keeping with the amount of exercise they did because of the centrally mediated component. So the flare-up can be later and much more severe than it should be from a purely loading-based perspective.
And so that influences both our assessment and our treatment. But typically, from knowing more of this and noticing it clinically, how does that directly influence the way in which we treat that shoulder?
It's confining the load in more, so we can really pin it the patient down to what they should be doing and what they actually are doing, and trying to get them, as you said just now, about sort of relative rest to a degree. They do need to take the strain off, and it's far easier to quantify that when we talk about the lower limb, where it's obvious, it's walking and running and things. Whereas for the upper limb, it's the patients don't realise what they do with their arm in the day. And that's the big challenge, is sometimes just helping them realise when they're moving it. I've known of physios in the past where they might just stick a bit of strapping on their shoulder. So when the patient moves it, they get a bit of proprioceptive feedback of, I'm moving my arm, and they start to realise what they're doing.
Yeah.
Okay. And that can be quite profound, I think.
And we could say then, more important to really hit home that message of relative rest, you probably get away with more in the lower limb.
Yeah, to a degree, I think so, because the load parameters are greater.
Okay.
So like I said, running will be plantar flexor load, 2.5-3 times body weight. Some people think it's up to six times body weight with running. Well, if they're just walking, it's 2 times. So they're miles away from it. So we can control it better. Whereas the upper limb, that's hard, because it probably needs far less to trigger symptoms.
Okay, no, that's great. And so if we were then to move to complete our set of common tendinopathies, what does the evidence suggest that we do differently with the condition formerly known as lateral epicondylitis? I'm sick of hearing it being called different things. Epicondylopathy. This drives me crazy. But yeah, was it covered in the conference? Is there anything groundbreaking coming more recently?
At the conference, the elbow is probably not covered that much, actually. There certainly wasn't any of the plenary speakers talking about the elbow, although Joe Gibson was talking about the upper limb. There's some posters from Luke Heels and Bill Fincenzino, who have done really probably the majority of the work in the elbow, with Coombs as well, who's a co-author normally with Bill Fincenzino as well. And what research is coming and how we sort of manage them. I don't know what research is coming at the moment in terms of what those groups are doing. There was a study the other year looking at compression for the lateral epicondylar region again, and that was showing that basically the radial head, when you're in a pronated position, actually raises up, so it becomes more anterior into the ECRB and ECRL, so extensor carpi radialis brevis and longus tendons, and compresses into them, so it acts as a cam again. So often it's not a true insertional tendinopathy, it's this cam position where the bone's compressing into it, and that explains why with a lot of tendinopathies you see cartilage formation and bone formation, the ossification, because that's the way our body deals with compressive loads. It produces cartilage or bone, and that's why the tendon changes structure. So what that means is that we probably want to rehabilitate some of our extensor capabilities in a supinated position where we're not compressing the tendon. And we also need to reduce the time that the patients spend in a pronated position. And if you think of the common elbow causing sort of symptoms, aggravating factors, sorry, that's often using keyboards, using a mouse, and drawing or writing, where you're in a pronated position whilst asking the extensors to hold that position to allow the flexors to work. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about a fine detailed job, so often I see this in architects and the like, where they're using the mouse a lot, but they're concentrating, they get quite tense because they focus and shift forwards towards their PCs, and the tension in those muscles raises. So then that puts more load on that particular zone of tendon and starts to cause the alterations. Mm. So clinically, I tend to see most pain, rather than actually on the humeral insertion, I'll come off the radial head and just drop in off that. So if you palpate radial head laterally, drop over and in, that's where I tend to find the site of most symptoms. But we've had a few debates on Twitter about that, and some people find it the opposite. But if you have a test of that, most of you, I think, will tend to find that's often the sorest point. Mm. And that tends to sort of coincide with this cam position. Also, Coombs' work particularly highlighted that there's probably distinct groups of patients where some have a higher sensitivity to the pressure pain testing. So they're really sensitive when you push on it. And other people will have much more symptoms based on mechanical tensile load through the muscle and tendon unit. And we can probably discriminate those two groups. The ones with the pressure pain sensory alterations are centrally mediated. And their group have shown that they respond well to lateral glides at the neck, normally around C5, C6, so radial nerve. And they actually glide there, and that reduces the pressure pain threshold in the elbow. Whereas the tensile loading induced groups, they will actually benefit more from the traditional sort of muscle tendon loading type strategies that we use, whether that's eccentric or not, and whether it includes pronation or not is the other option. But clinically, if we've got a really sore one, we might load in supinated position and progress to a pronated position as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's always about the patient you've got in front of you and sussing out what they can tolerate. So again, go back to the aftermath, how they feel after they've tried their loading, and judge what's appropriate for that person at that time with their sort of pathology and sort of everything else.
With the shoulder, I feel like we're pretty good at resisting different movements to acknowledge which tendons might be more tendinopathic or certainly more aggravating. Yet at the elbow, seemingly it's let's just load extension. Do you feel like we could be better at differentially treating those individual tendons?
I think so. I think the research tends to support that it's the ECRB and ECRL tendon that are most involved from the histological samples that have been taken. And certainly when we teach it at the university, we'll teach the sort of tennis elbow test. We'll teach them with a bias to ECRB and ECRL, so involves radial deviation of the wrist rather than just pure extension. And that's why you've got your tests of resisted index or resisted middle finger sort of extension. Yeah, I do think we can test it, and that's how the test should be done, really. Whether that's what people clinically end up doing, I don't know, but they're my routine tests. If we're looking at the elbow, would be sort of resisted isometric hold with radial deviation with the elbow bent, so Cozen's test, and then I'll look at the other tests. We could argue these tests aren't that sensitive and aren't that specific, absolutely, but as with all physio, it's taking into account your subjective assessment and your objective together, then we get a difference.
And again, if we acknowledge that they're pain provocative, they've always got a place in terms of a retest. Yeah. Several weeks and months down the line, if that is less painful, that test has been valuable. So we can't completely rule them out, and certainly we should be still teaching students that.
Absolutely, and we'll also use grip strength as part of that. And one of my tests that guide my intervention is, if grip strength is problematic, or these other tests are, I'll often put my hand around the sort of extensor muscles and compress and get them to redo the test. Now, if that alters their pain response on that loading test, then we can conclude that for that person, a clasp, an epicondylar clasp, may be useful to just spread the load in a different manner. Now, I know we don't like these things all the time, but if it's a patient who's, let's say, a builder and needs to be working and is going to be working, it may offer us a way of just controlling the load through the sort of sore part of the tendon, and that will help him stay working, which is why we're there at the end of the day.
As long as we're sensible about how we present that as a treatment modality, make sure we're not perceiving that they're being patched up, which I know is something that none of us like.
It's not a treatment by itself. It's a... this allows you to keep working. These are your exercises that are going to change your problem via whatever mechanism we want to sort of go down that route with, and they need doing. And obviously, Bill Finch, as you know, has done a lot of work on MWMs, which, again, as manual therapy, gets a bit of a bad press at the moment. But MWMs for lateral epicondylar pain have been shown to be very, very useful, and should always form part of your assessment, both as a differential, because if they respond to it, it suggests we might have that issue, but also as a treatment. And patients can be clearly taught these exercises to do at home using doorways or wall corners to self-mob and give them some relief to allow them to then go and finish their plumbing, their carpentry job, whatever it happens to be, because it's often the DIYer that needs that type of thing. Or I say DIYer, the workman as well.
Yeah, of course. No, that makes sense. And so, is there anything other than what we've plugged as we've gone through that you'd like to point people in the direction of?
I don't think so, actually, Jack, to be honest. I think you've covered everything. So all the podcasts that have already been done by all the proper tendon sort of experts.
Are you not a proper one yet?
No.
I'm intrigued. No. When do you become a proper one, sir?
Only, I think, when you've got a shed load of publications and have a PhD at the end, hopefully, as well. So I've just done my advanced postgraduate Viva this week, which allows me to call myself a PhD candidate now. So when you start a PhD, you're not a PhD candidate, you're an advanced postgraduate. So that's my first step, and I'm in the midst of writing up my work now, so I'm focusing on writing it. I've completed all my research projects, so we're year two of my PhD, and it's just now getting that sorted. So I guess probably 5 years away from being a proper tendon expert.
Well, I'll have to canvass our listeners who are a big fan of the way in which you disseminate information, see if they consider you proper as we do here at the podcast. So thanks again for your time, and we'll, I'm sure, be speaking soon.
Massive pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And that was session 11. Huge thanks to Seth once again, and I'm sure you'll all agree he's a tendon expert in our book. He has a knack of prioritising clinical relevance, which is what we're all about, so I'm sure you'll appreciate his work. Sign up to the show notes newsletter for written resources and links to all discussed blogs and podcasts at the podcast page of choosehealth.co.uk. Also, please take a few minutes to review us on iTunes, because up till now your passive nature is making us look rubbish. We'll be back next month with more clinical gold delivered direct. Find me on Twitter at choose_health. Find Seth at Seth O'Neill, and the podcast team tweet from at TPM Podcast. Also, next month, 10th of November, we will be running a physio talk hosted by myself and Helen Preston from Preston's Health, which will be trying to develop a consensus for low back pain. It's sure to be an interesting project, so check it out. It'll be under hashtag PhysioTalk, and that's 10th of November, 8 till 9 p.m, Greenwich Mean Time. You've been listening to the Physio Matters podcast, discussing physio matters because physio matters. Bye for now.